Well, this hour, as we continue chatting with Paul LeMay about the mind, why people do what they do, we'll take your calls as well on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Paul LeMay with us. He is the co-author of the book Primal Mind, Primal Games, Why We Do What We Do. Back to telepathy, Paul, for a moment. Are you saying then that telepathy is caused by the brain primarily?
No.
Aha.
Say that. I wouldn't say that. I would say that there is a biomolecular structure within our bodies, and not just in the brain, could be in the heart, could be in any of the living tissue, that is sensitive to quantum-based information. Photons, you see, George, most of the biochemistry that is taught today is taught with Valerie Hunt. I don't know if you remember or know of the late UCLA physiologist by the name of Valerie Hunt, but she did a lot of research in telemetry research pioneer in vibratory states in the human body, and she found vibratory states that far exceeded what we see today in a lot of the conventional brain science, where we say that the brain waves only go up to, say, 40, maybe 45 hertz. She said, that's just rubbish. We have vibrations in the body that go well into the hundreds of thousands of cycles a second. And, of course, her mainstream colleagues were aghast when she would say such things, because it would imply that our physiology is capable of much, much more than what we've been told. So this is part of the problem with which we have right now. Science itself has been somewhat victimized. So now let's get back to this. Your question, the core of your question, is it the body that's doing this? No, but the body is acting as these little structures, these hexagonal, pentagonal, or aromatic rings, are essentially holders of this energy state. And now, if you do the math, and we've done it in our second book just for fun to see what would happen, the computational information holding capability of our bodies is in extraordinary astronomical numbers, like in the numbers like sextillion, you know. So when you get into that kind of computational capability, it would suggest to us that the information that's not just within us as beings, as souls, whatever that may be, you know, from previous incarnations, but for those, the information that's in the universe at large, you know, it's held, they call it the Akashic field, that we know from just conventional physics that what we call the empty space isn't empty at all. It's charged with massive amounts of information or energy, and that holds information in and of itself. We don't talk about it that way in conventional physics, although John Wheeler, a famous physicist from Princeton University who worked with Einstein, he had talked about his three phases of his career. We said in his first phase was everything was particles, in the second phase of his career everything was waves, and in the third phase of his career everything was information. So in a sense, what he was trying to convey there is that information is actually the base condition for all energetic manifestation in our universe. So that's why I'm using the word information here with photons. Light that comes from the sun is not maybe just light. It's holding informational potential. And just as our souls are holding informational potential, so these are at a quantum state. That's the difference between electrons, which is the normative biochemical model, talks about electrons all the time, and photons. Electrons belong to what are called the fermionic family, and they are belonging to, generally speaking, a quantum wave state collapsed configuration, whereas information that's from photonic sources is non-quantum wave collapsed, which means it's indeterminate. That indeterminacy is the reason why information can flow in this non-ordinary way. What's interesting to me is that when you and I are exchanging words, right, mm-hmm. we are using a language system. That language system in and of itself is a wave collapsing system. And that means that it tends to limit our ability to experience. It's as though categorical thinking is built on collapsing wave states, whereas when you're in a meditative state, you're not necessarily, and you're beyond what's called the discursive mind in Buddhism, which is beyond language, you are receiving information at massive rates. And in a sense, you have mystical sight. You can see reality from a multiplexed or omnivalent view. And you're just as when people reporting on near-death experiences, where not only are they having a white light experience, but some of them are reporting how they have their entire life will flash
right before
through them. Within a matter of seconds, right?
Everything they did.
Everything, down to details. And this question is, how in heck would that be possible? Because the brain alone cannot process that volume of information in such a tiny amount of time. Now, what a lot of people don't know, and I'll add to this discussion right here, is that when you look at all of the major classes of hallucinogens, be it DMT, psilocybin, LSD, or whatever, all of them have a huge population. When you look at a molecular diagram called Lewis diagram, you'll see that those molecules are full of these aromatic rings. Is it any coincidence that they are packed with aromatic rings?
And I don't think there are coincidences, ever.
No, they're associated with these altered states and these higher states of awareness. And just the conventional neurotransmitters of dopamine and serotonin are themselves also built around these aromatic ring structures. And they're associated with motivating us, right? And for our sense of well-being. So this is not a coincidence. This is a signpost that we need to pay attention, that these structures are built within our system. So all I can say is when we get back to this question about where does the primal mind fit into all this, well, I would say that the primal mind is just your baseline. It's a baseline operating system for having a body in an environment. But that doesn't mean it's the limits of the system. The system is gifted with this huge, subtle structure that's capable of dealing with light. How else can we explain people who have memories of previous lives, people who have near-death experiences, people who have telepathy? And there's a lot of good evidence in science today that would say that, by Daryl Bem and Dean Radin, that would say, telepathy is not pseudoscience. It is science. And the current mainstream science hasn't caught on to this yet. Why? Because categorical thinking is collapsing the very thinking processes of a lot of the scientists who are not being open to really what's going on. That's not to say all scientists do that. Einstein, John Wheeler, and many others, Rupert Sheldrake, these people have gone back to becoming, we could call them, scientist mystics. They understand that there is this subtle dimension of reality that is really the thing that's calling us to investigate, because that's our true nature. We're being called on a path, and so the primal mind is just one part of the process of instructing the soul in what we need to learn here on Earth, with that compassion and maybe some wisdom lessons, but that doesn't tell the whole story. It's a part of the story, and it's probably a very necessary part of the story, because I think it's the discipline that we need in order to become quantum beings, just like that character Q in Star Trek. You need to have a disciplined mind with virtuous conduct to live in a quantum realm. Otherwise, it becomes mayhem.
Paul, you have looked at the work of one of our guests, Bruce Lipton. Tell me.
Yes. Yes. Now, there's a lot of territory to cover in that. Bruce has said some really interesting things. One of the things he said is that intelligence is found on the membrane, outer membrane of cells, for example. He's gone beyond that. He's gone into the question about consciousness having an impact on changing the genetic makeup of our bodies. Now, the model that I just presented about these aromatic rings begins to provide the interface mechanism between how a conscious state could possibly have an impact on DNA structures and the creation of new proteins. That's where it gets interesting. That's where we can say our minds are creating, in a sense, part of our physical reality. And in that sense, we can be shaping our behaviors, not just our behaviors, but our very physical states to become something that is much more open-ended or something that is actually closed down. And when it's closed down, my suggestion is that that's more likely associated with illness. That's more likely associated with psychological and spiritual complaint.
Where is intelligence based? In the brain? Or is it outside of the brain?
That's Rupert Sheldrake, who's a friend of mine, and he's maintained the idea for a long time that the mind and the intelligence associated with the mind is a field proposition
right.
that exists right. independent of the brain.
Do you agree with that?
I agree. I would agree with like maybe 90% of that. I would say one should not be so quick as to dismiss the physiological structures that are accompanying the field, the mind field. Because we, after all, we are human beings. And there is a purpose for us to being in an incarnated state. So the fact that our physiology at a subtle, at this microscopic, like the tiniest of microscopic states, is capable of actually holding this kind of information, which suggests that the field itself is being maintained or amplified
by
interface with the environment and other people.
Who maintains the field, though? What creates that?
That intelligence is probably...
Is it God?
I would say that the creation, you know, like we grew up with the story of God creating the universe and the earth and all animal kind and humankind. As you age, you start becoming a little bit more sophisticated and assume, well, that's a very pretty childhood story. But, you know, I think there is a great deal of legitimacy to the idea that there is a supra-intelligence that's embedded in the universe that is actually responsible for the design of these systems. It's certainly not something we're designing. I didn't incarnate into this world with the idea, oh, I better have some aromatic ring of amino acids and DNA aromatic rings to make sure that I'm capable of interfacing with my, you know, like an avatar with this body. I didn't create that, nor did you, nor did any scientists on this planet. That comes from something much bigger than us. And if you want to call that God, I'm perfectly comfortable with that idea. I have no problem with that. But it is a higher order of intelligence that may be embedded within the universe itself, which could be of incalculable age, right?
Well, that's possible, too. It's fascinating work. Where does science take this next, Paul? I mean, what happens next?
I think science itself, George, is having to go through a transformation. I think we're at with the dawn of the quantum age in the 1920s, it's almost been, not quite, we're almost at a 100-year mark of quantum physics coming into existence. And yet, we have yet to embrace the full implications of what that insight means to reality, to consciousness, and to even to our spiritual dimensions. And I think science, you know, quantum physics is probably the most troubling paradigm for conventional material science. It does not find, it doesn't, like Einstein said, he didn't like spooky action at a distance. Scientists And people generally are mystified by what the heck is going on with this stuff. And yet, that's where science has brought us. And it's now saying this is the next step in our evolutionary journey. So, you know, when we look at the cover of the book and it's got a chimp in front of a chessboard, and if chimps, and I believe chimps are our common ancestor, we come from a common ancestor, we are on an evolutionary journey, and not just an evolutionary journey of the corporeal being, but an evolutionary journey of our soul being, but incarnated. So the incarnational experience as human beings, I remember going to a Buddhist teaching not too long ago, and a woman told me, she said, the beauty of the human experience is that it's between a divine realm and a hell realm, and that we get to experience both. And what's so very interesting about that is that because of that, we are capable of having the potential of an enlightenment, because the enlightened state has to be able to take in the full gamut, the full spectrum of all existential possibilities. And that's the part. A lot of people want to transcend the physical and say, you know, the body, what a drag, you know, it's going to die. What, you know, the ultimate enlightenment experience is beyond body. Well, maybe it isn't. Maybe it's a much more complex proposition, that the body is a necessary stepping stone for the higher evolutionary state that is being played out in this universe.
So I'm looking at the chimpanzee on the cover of your book.
Yeah.
Does it have a soul?
Oh, I think animals have souls.
You do?
Oh, I do. I do. I mean, look at pantheism. I mean, that's not my creation. The idea of pantheism, which is embraced by a lot of Native Americans, they say that rocks have souls, trees have souls. When I live here in British Columbia, when they want to chop a tree down to make a totem pole or a dugout canoe,
mm-hmm.
they go to the tree and they have a dialogue and they ask forgiveness from the tree before they cut it down. And they tell the tree what they're going to use it for. Now, that you know, Western anthropologists would say, oh, that's all animism. You know, that's like a silly idea. Well, you know, I have a feeling that we're coming full circle. We're beginning to sense that, no, the whole universe is alive. The sun is alive. People have said that for years. The earth is alive. But it's the definitions. Again, we're back to categorical thinking. If you build a worldview that's locked into a collapsed wave state, you cannot possibly experience, or that's too absolutist on my side. You are going to reduce your capability or ability to have those experiences. I think those experiences burst through every once in a while, regardless of a person's belief system. It's almost like they're inconvenient truths that, you know, bleed into the story, whether we like it or not. Leonard Cohen has a famous line in one of his songs about there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. And I think that's really what we're going through in our paradigm of consciousness right now. We're locked in the primal mind paradigm of human consciousness.
All right, Paul, stay with us. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and take promised phone calls with you. They're all lining up. Paul LeMay with us, co-author of the book Primal Mind, Primal Games. We will be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back, Paul. As we go to calls, tell me, what was your favorite part of this recent book, Primal Mind, Primal Games?
Well, I would say that the second book, the last chapter, was the thing that blew my mind. And with the stuff that I kind of laid out for you in the last, you know, in the last 20 minutes, half an hour, that completely caught me by surprise. And it was a serendipitous discovery with the assistance of an electrochemist friend of mine. And it took me in directions, you know, George, that I never thought I would ever discover in my life. And for me, it suddenly allowed spirituality and science to meet on a common ground. And believe me, I never thought that would happen in my lifetime. And now I think it's well within our reach.
All right, let's go to the phones now, as promised. Scott is truck driving in New Hampshire. By the time we get to you, Scott, you're probably in Connecticut.
Yeah, actually, it's New Hampshire, but that's okay. Great. Thanks for having me on, George. And I like the research on the primal brain mind. I have a two-part question.
All right.
My first question is, you know, animals and people definitely have a difference. What part of the brain would faith, say you have a faith in a creator, which animals, I don't think, proven, don't have that same capacity? And also, my other question is with AI technology, I like your research where you say the body works in tandem almost, where light or energy comes into the body and then is expelled out. Kind of like if you read in the Bible, Jesus is the sun, and the sunlight that he admits is like that energy for us beings. If we're created in the image of God, that we absorb the same energy and expel the same energy just on a mass scale because we're human. But I do, Elon Musk said that if we tap into this AI, we could be releasing a demon. And for a scientist guy to, you know, say that, a scientist, it's just kind of amazing that he would bring spirituality in with science and technology. So what's your thoughts on AI? Like, are we ever going to reach where the body, because right now I think AI is a brain that's separate from a body, which God's creation is almost perfected. Where can man duplicate that? And what's your thoughts on that?
Okay, so you had a two-part question. One was, the first part was about the animals.
Animals and God.
Yeah, animals and God. Well, I guess I can't answer that question. If I could, I would be an extraordinary being. I can say that certainly in Buddhism, they talk about the animal realm as being a lower realm than the human realm. So there's a certain level of capacity of consciousness that probably belongs to the animal realm. And whether one can say that they have a concept of God is, you know, debatable point. Maybe in, like, if you own a dog, in the dog's eyes, a human being is as close to a god as, you know, they probably can imagine. Okay, but to your second question about artificial intelligence and Elon Musk and so forth, artificial intelligence is an interesting proposition because really what I think is it is a distillation of the action potential system that I was talking about earlier about neurons being an on-off switch system. In fact, that's how our computers actually work, on-off switching with zeros and ones. So when it comes to the definition of intelligence, again, that becomes a problematic problem for me in terms of how we construct or conceive of the idea of intelligence. I don't think artificial intelligence at this point is actually intelligent. I think it's just a machine system. When you look at television shows like Star Trek, with Star Trek The New Generation with the android named Data, it's assumed in that program that Data has achieved a certain level of self-awareness. That day may be coming. With the invention of quantum computing, and here where I live in Vancouver, just down the road in a suburb just east of Vancouver is D-Wave. And D-Wave is one of the leading quantum computing manufacturing companies in the world. And that raises a lot of interesting questions because that's a lot closer to the stuff that I was talking about with indeterminate wave states being information-bearing, and that they can achieve non-ordinary connections with reality. That introduces a very troublesome question because, as in the movie The Terminator, where you had AI essentially take over the planet, we are looking at very much possible the birth of that Skynet-like system. We're not there yet, But I think, you know, given enough a couple of decades, it is very conceivable that we will have thinking machines that are capable not just of high-speed processing, but are capable of feats that we were talking about in terms of telepathy and telekinesis. Now, that sounds like really out-of-the-box science fiction talk from a guy like me who is a science writer. But I, you know, stranger things have happened, and I think they're tapping into something that is a real Pandora's box right now. So I'm actually glad that Elon Musk said what he did, because I think it's not just the science fiction movies we should be referring to, but when you actually have a practicing scientist who's out there doing a lot of great things, and then he comes out and says, you know, we should be thinking about this. We know we're getting close to that possibility.
Brenda's in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Brenda. Go ahead.
Hi, George Murray. Thank you for having me.
Sure thing.
I've been listening for a couple of hours and spinning round and round, but was calling about to see what you had to say about Carl Sagan and the cosmic consciousness and genetic memory.
That's an interesting question. Paul, can you react to that?
Yeah, I'm familiar with Carl Sagan's work. He wrote a book many years ago about the dragons of Eden. And the irony is that on the public stage, Carl Sagan was not one who waxed poetic when it came to spiritual matters. I don't know if he did, if he had an behind-the-scenes alternative ego where he actually professed those spiritual ideas, but to my knowledge, he was very circumspect around that, and he tended to stick to his guns around his interpretation. So if you know something that I don't, I'd be certainly interested in hearing, Brenda, more about it, because I'm not that familiar with that side of Carl Sagan.
You know, he was responsible for the movie Contact.
He was, and I think it was his wife, if I'm not mistaken, who co-wrote the screenplay with him.
And I think he died before it came out.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure he did.
Yes.
He's missed.
Yes. And now that movie, when you think about it, that movie had a lot of very interesting sci-fi propositions thrown into it as well, right?
It sure did.
When you see the character traveling through the time tunnel, just like it was in the 2001 Space Odyssey, very similar concept. So you kind of wonder, where was that coming from? Because Carl didn't talk about stuff like that. You know, that was kind of a way, maybe he talked about stuff like that with his wife and with a close circle of friends. But I don't think in the public sphere he was actually engaging in that kind of speculation.
No, he believed that there was extraterrestrial life, but he didn't believe it was going anyplace, visiting us and things like that.
Right.
Let's go to Mark in Redding, California, west of the Rockies. Hey, Mark, go ahead.
Hi, George. Fascinating show tonight.
Thank you.
I wanted to tell a story about a friend of mine who recovered from paralysis after a stroke using a TENS unit, but I'd like to make a quick sidestep off to a couple of points I wanted to bring up with Paul. He had talked about the intelligence of cells existing on the surface of the cells, and I know that your guest, John McAfee, George, had talked about quorum sensing in cells, which was conducted at Princeton University by Bonnie Bassler. She has an excellent video on the TED series that you can find that really explains how it goes. But basically, there's a base chemical that all cells use to communicate with one another, and then the speciation or the specific cell group or the type of germ, whatever it happens to be, has a suffix, a little tag that goes on that identifies specifically the receptor site that it's going to connect with on the cell that it's sending a message to. And this is how viruses and germs know that there are enough members of their colony to attack the host and launch the disease. That's why when you get the virus or the flu virus, it takes 11 days for you to actually get sick, because it's busy building up its population before it says, okay, we got enough guys to go, let's fight, you know, let's attack. But anyway, so if you take that idea as a proposition for neuroplasticity, the idea that the brain can rewire itself, this is what I was thinking when my friend, actually his girlfriend, who's a nurse, told me that he'd had a stroke and that he was paralyzed on the left side of his body. About 80% of his body was paralyzed on his left side. And I had this theory connected to neuroplasticity that if you use the TENS unit, which you mentioned earlier about transcutaneous electroneurostimulation, you use it to stimulate the muscles, and the muscles, in my theory anyway, would send a signal back up to the brain saying, okay, I did what you asked me to, I contracted, now what? And sooner or later, the brain's going to say, what's he talking about? Where's this message coming from? And it's going to try to reconnect to that muscle group. Well, it worked. And within 4 months, this guy had regained 80% of all its motor control.
Wow.
On the left side of his body. Now, you know, I don't know. I've never seen a study where anybody's tried to do this, but it actually worked. And I couldn't believe it. But I've never seen anyone follow up on that.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I know what Bonnie Bassar's work about quorum sensing. I'm very familiar with that. There, you could say that there are parallel processes in the biology of cells, one of which is the key and lock system. When talking about membranes, where you have stuff come in and go out. The key lock system is the standard model for explaining what goes on in cell respiration and nutrient intake and waste product output. However, there is another side to this, and that has to do with the vibratory state of cells. And with my electrochemist friend of mine, we were talking about this at some length for over many months. And he said to me one day, Paul, I think that this whole key and lock system is only a partial explanation. I think it's all based on resonance, and that resonance is basically a frequency proposition that's propagated by electromagnetics and other possible sources of energy. If photonics is part of it, I don't know. But when we come back to what you were talking about, the rehabilitation of neurons in a stroke victim, and I know of which you speak because my father had a stroke, and he was paralyzed on one side. So rehabilitation, I have a feeling when you dig into the science of neurons, you quickly realize, like with MS research, that one of the key factors in rehabilitation is the coating that goes around the myelin, the sheath that goes around neurons. Now, it's been discovered that the myelin sheath is actually, it's a form of glial cell, and that it's intelligent. And it's the myelin that determines the firing rate of a neuron. And there's these things called nodes of Ranvier. It looks like, you remember, you go into a butcher shop, you see these tied off wieners in series?
Mm-hmm.
That's what that is. So what this cell structure does, based on the length of the node, determines the firing rate of the neuron. So why I'm bringing this forward is because when you say there was a stimulation given to a particular region of the body, it's not necessarily that the neurons themselves are taking in the information and doing a readaptation. Because the neurons, to be quite honest, neurons are almost dumb wires. And it's proposed that the myelin is actually the intelligence which gives the programming to the neurons, telling them what to do and how to fire, you know, in terms of rate. So this is a very complex topic, and I'm really encouraged to hear the story that you told anecdotally, because it would suggest that there is some kind of energetic proposition at play in the programming of and reprogramming and rehabilitation of the neurons, you know, through an exogenous source. And so that's encouraging to hear.
Paul, where do we get your books?
Well, you can get them online, George. It's harder to get them in the States. They're certainly on sale in Canada, you know, through the internet now. But yeah, Amazon carries them online in the form of electronic books. So yeah.
Excellent. Paul, thank you. Keep in touch with us, okay?
All right.
You got one of those minds we want to keep talking to.
Yeah, okay. Thank you, George.
All right. Paul LeMay, his website linked up at coasttocoastam.com for you. On our next Coast to Coast program, of course, in addition to those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines, we'll talk a little bit about Bigfoot and some other supernatural things. So make sure you're part of the show. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.